Welcome to T-Smack, home of the T-Smack. May I take your order?
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Talking Smack, where we talk superheroes, movies, animation, comics, and much, much more. I am your host, Josh Scar, and joining me, as always, is everyone's favorite bald tabaxi boy with mange. It's Alex. Alex, how you doing?
I am doing fantastic, because there is nothing more than I love over the weekend than families, the spirit of unity, and what we have coming up for our reviews, which is that it's all about family.
We're reviewing a Fast and the Furious movie?
No. Family, the Great Uniter. I hear there's a family of infiltrators, but there's also the family you make along the way while harvesting grain on the moon.
Why do you keep talking about Spy Family? So we're going to go old school with this one. We did a double feature. We were planning on doing two movies this week, but Alex was under the weather for the limited screenings that we had in our area for Spy Family Code White. And I canceled my Netflix subscription, and I'm not going to waste my money watching Rebel Moon, which may or may not be a good thing. I don't know. We'll find out, because Alex will tell us about that. So we're going to kind of do our own thing where I will review Spy Family Code White. Alex can ask questions. We'll take a break. And then when we come back, Alex will review Rebel Moon Part 2. And I will ask questions like, why? We're going to keep it simple and dive right into it. So, Alex, I know you have a general understanding of Spy Family, yes?
Yeah, it's kind of like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but cuter.
Yeah.
And a lot darker in areas.
So the general premise is this is an anime world where two nations are in like a Cold War. They've recently finished a war and they're trying to not ignite a new one, but they're kind of constantly at odds with each other. And they're not too dissimilar from like Germany and Poland or the United States and Russia. It's a vaguely European country called West Dallas, which for a local person, it's kind of funny because in the Milwaukee suburbs, there's a Milwaukee suburb called West Alice, which is spelled the exact same way. And the locals call it Stalas, which is nothing, but I just want to prove to anyone that is from the Milwaukee area, I know the Stalas. I'm down with the Stalas.
See, I thought you were saying West Dallas, and I'm like, huh.
Nope, West Alice. But it's not A-L-I-C-E. It's like A-L-L-I-S.
Okay.
And again, I believe it's spelled fairly similar, if not the same, in Spy Family. And then there's Estonia, which is the country that most of the show / manga takes place in. This is a place where like fascism is secretly brewing underneath. Segments of the government or the military are trying to rise up in the name of fascism and start a new war with West Alice. And West Alice has sent their best spy, Twilight, to try and maintain the peace. And the way he's going to do that is he's going to create a family and infiltrate into a private school to try and get close to the general who is more than likely trying to ignite this Cold War into a full-fledged war. So he has to adopt a daughter who just so happens to be a psychic. He's not aware of it, and she keeps it secret. And he has to get into a false marriage to cover up so he doesn't seem suspicious being a single dad. And he ends up marrying the single greatest assassin in Estonia, in Yor. Y-O-R is her name. She is waifu goals. I'll just say that right now. Yor is like, we did the waifu challenge, and I've given Slade guff for a long time now that why would you not put Yor in the waifu challenge? Which, to Slade's point, Spy Family lags in certain parts of the show where the biggest draw, at least for me, of the show is when they do the Mr. and Mrs. Smith thing where like, so the reason no one ever finds anything out is that one, Anya understands that both her parents need to keep their secrets safe for reasons. She's only 6, 4, 5, something like that. Like her age is actually hidden. She pretends to be 6, but she's probably younger. Hmm. But she understands enough due to her psychic abilities that mama needs to keep her assassinating a secret. Papa needs to keep his spying a secret. So she does what she can to kind of keep the peace and not let anyone in on the secret. But the show works best when it's like Anya and Parent working on their own mission while someone else is off doing another thing. And Anya kind of interjects into the other thing when they're doing like their spy mission or an assassin mission. And I think that's where the show really shines. You get Anya being involved, and then you get like some really cute, playful moments where, like in this movie, spoiler alert for Spy Family Code White, Yor sneaks onto the airship that Anya has been kidnapped onto while Twilight, Lloyd, the dad, is beating the shit out of all these people that are trying to ignite a new war. And she just like shows up in the cockpit and they're like, Yor, what are you doing here? She's just like, I snuck aboard the cargo hold and just happened to find you despite me just having fought a giant mech man. But we're not going to talk about that. And then Lloyd has to like crash land the plane, and Yor asks him like, you know how to fly this thing? And him being a master spy, he's like, yeah, but he can't tell her that. So he's like, I was in a flying club in college. And she believes him. It just goes on. The willful ignorance is just amazing, because like there is some mysticism sort of stuff at play in the Spy Family world where Yor, being this super trained assassin, she can like sense evil auras of people. And mm-hmm. so when she's around Lloyd, because Lloyd is someone who is on the side of good, he is trying to maintain peace. She never really assumes anything out of his aura. So because he's never using ulterior, selfish, or vindictive motives, or selfish motives, evil motives, she's just like, okay, yeah, he's on the up and up because he's not setting off my radar. And Lloyd, being the super spy that he is, has no idea that someone as high profile as the Thorn Princess would be this random person that he decided to marry. There's just no way. He's like too self-assured in his spying.
Yeah,
that's the kind of basic premise of it and why they don't figure anything out. And it's adorable. It's a found family sort of thing with a very slow burn romance. And this movie is it's a canon adventure that happens in the show, and it plays out like a multi-arc episodic portion of a season. But I think that actually is a little bit of a downfall. Like if you're here from the Movie Wire, Justin sent you our way to kind of talk a little bit more in depth about Spy Family. And I'm not going to go too deep into it, but this is a show I really enjoy. And I think that there are some really good aspects to it. But if you're ever going to dive into it, just know that there are like 3 to 6 episode arcs that drag on.
Really?
And this one really, really kind of drags in the middle of the movie. I think probably by the midway point of the movie, we are on the airship and building up towards the climax of the movie. But it kind of drags throughout, just padding out time to get to that big conclusion. Recently, I was on The Cultworthy, where Slade brought Jujutsu Kaisen Zero, which is a prequel movie to the Jujutsu Kaisen TV show. And I had made the comment that this movie felt like the Jujutsu Kaisen Zero movie. It felt like they just tried to cram in all the tropes of the show into one movie.
Mm.
So like every couple scenes, there's like a transition, and it's like, if you want to join in on the show, you'll get this kind of episode. And then if that little episodic scene plays out, and then if you want to watch you'll get this kind of episode and this kind of episode. This felt a lot like that, where instead of being interested in telling a cohesive story, it was more like, let's hit the beats that everyone comes to Spy Family for. We've got the weird, awkward moment where Yor gets drunk and hits on Lloyd, despite her being like very reserved and knowing that they have an arranged marriage, so she never really puts the moves on him. And then Lloyd being like overly affectionate, trying to assure her that he is very much interested in her if she were interested in him. But they can never communicate that because he's more interested in his mission and she's too busy trying to respect his wishes, because he told her that he's a widower and he's just trying to respect his deceased wife's wishes by getting Anya into school. And then Anya's just a 5-year-old with psychic powers and she wreaks havoc and she's amazing. But it's a very fun movie if you enjoy Spy Family, but I would not say this is what you need to dive into Spy Family for. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this is like the best introduction to Spy Family. I think the best introduction to Spy Family is the first episode.
Okay.
There's a lot of stuff that's done in there. And the end of the first episode is probably one of my favorite gags, because they spend most of that episode just trying to get Anya in to get studied up for an entrance exam to this private school. She's like one of the final four, bottom four of the top people who can now interview for the school. And Lloyd's like super proud of her. He lifts her up, gives her a little big daddy spin. And then he just like collapses on the ground. And he's like, what the hell just happened? I relaxed for a second and his body just like the years of the spy just weighed on him. And his body just collapsed under the exhaustion of just constantly being on alert as a spy. And that proud daddy moment just like broke him. Aww. And I'm like, that's the perfect setup for what kind of show this can be. And for the most part is, but it gets sidetracked with some things. Like, I think there's like a 4 or 5 episode arc in season one that's completely dedicated to a Twilight mission with a spy that he trained up where they're just in a tennis tournament. Like it's an interesting tennis tournament. It's an underground tennis tournament where people can like cheat and be roided up and stuff. So they do some stuff that's interesting, but it's not what I come to that show for.
So, all right, a few questions. I'm trying to get a baseline for this. Is it better than the Konosuba movie?
Again, I think it's different. I think, or at least my perspective was a little different going into, like, I wasn't expecting this to be something that affected the show because some people aren't going to go see the movie. So you need it to be a fun adventure that doesn't affect the overall story of the TV show that people are invested in.
Okay.
I think Konosuba, they actually did do that where it is canon. It's something that counts and it's something that has progressed the show a little bit.
Yeah.
But with this one, it really just feels like they kind of started at point A, did a little adventure that looped them right back around to point A.
Oh, okay.
They grew a little closer as a family, but none of it felt substantial enough that it's like, this will change the way the show is viewed. This will change certain relationships in the show.
So it's more like the Simpsons movie, kind of it treaded water, yes. But they had a big budget.
Yeah, exactly. And like the budget, the animation is really good. There are some really great shots and you can see there's an entire sequence dedicated to Anya dreaming about being able to go poop on a toilet where she encounters the poop god. And there's just like this amazing psychedelic scene where this weird monk dude is like constantly flashing his tighty whities at the screen while he's like, come on, Anya, you've earned the opportunity to go poop. Just poop. It's fine.
Oh, that's funny.
It's adorable. And they do some really good stuff with Anya and her expressions. Like I expect there to be a lot more Anya memes once this becomes available for home release or Pirate Bay, whatever happens, but there will be some amazing Anya facial GIFs out there. GIFs. However you prefer to pronounce it. But yeah, it's fun, but I was hoping that it would be a little more substantial, not necessarily like breaking the show and being like Lloyd and Yor are now an item and like openly PDAing and whatnot. Like that's not what I was expecting. And that's not what the movie needed to do, but I was just hoping for something. Like even if it was just Anya getting an extra merit at school with the plot that they had set up, she needs to get a recipe for her principal's favorite dish so she can win a contest at school and get an extra merit. Because the idea is if she gets 8 merits, she can have a special meeting with this general, among other people. And that's Lloyd's in to try and stop the Cold War or prevent the Cold War from erupting.
Okay. So one further question I have about this franchise is Anya the only one with psychic magical abilities, or is this kind of like an established thing in the world?
Yeah, Anya is the only one that we have been introduced to, but the show acknowledges a couple times that there are children who have been experimented on, not too dissimilar from Nazis experimenting on Jewish people and other people.
Mm.
But in this case, in this fictional world, psychic abilities happen. But there is a dog named Bond that they have adopted as well, who can see the future. And so whenever he gets to see the future, Anya can read his mind and she can see how things are going to progress.
Okay.
So like I said, there are some like supernatural things, paranormal things in play here to kind of keep things interesting. It's not just spy gadgets and whatnot, but it's a cute show and the movie was cute. I would say it's a pass for me, honestly. I know Justin gave it like a 3 out of his 5 4-star rating system, which I completely agree with. I think on its own, it is a very fun movie, but it loops back to point A by the end of it. And I don't know. I want some kind of character growth.
Yeah.
And it never really felt like it moved on from that point.
I feel like maybe the show that probably did it best was Cowboy Bebop, because it came out after the movie, the TV show was ended, but they backslated it, whatever. They put up, I think, between episodes 16 and 17 before some big stuff happened at the end of the season. And the reason why it worked is because the first front half of Cowboy Bebop's 24 episodes are very serialized. It's just, we're doing a thing, we're on a mission. That's kind of what we do before it really starts to do the churn of their story. And we're really going to delve into this and go for the, you know, go for the gut punches. So it kind of makes sense. It was just a little bit of A and B. But then also the way Cowboy Bebop did their movie was the TV show was very much based on jazz. That's all the music. The movie was a rock soundtrack, which kind of lets you know. It's like, yeah, it's Cowboy Bebop, but it's a little different. It's got some edge. You know, we're throwing back to before the end of the season. So you know what happened. You know, we know some stuff happened, but we're putting you in a good, happy, thrilling movie. You know, this is a rock opera movie. You know, I really dig that. So, I mean,
yeah, the only other anime that I've seen that has had similar processing, where it's like season movie sort of thing, or like season capping with a movie, was Gundam 00, which creator of our show logo, Derek, he was very Gundam is his thing. So he's obsessed with Gundam, and Gundam 00 is his favorite. I think it was partly because it's like one of the first ones he ever saw, but I can also see why. There's some really good stuff in there, and it's got a good message. It's not necessarily fun, but it's enjoyable. It's kind of what if Gundam did Attack on Titan, but as a political thriller, which, I mean, Attack on Titan is kind of a political thriller as well.
Yeah.
But it's the way they did it is they did one season movie, come back to new season, which the movie is canon. It affects the story. So if you come into season two and you don't know what happened in the movie, you're kind of screwed. And then season two goes through its story, and then another movie, which caps off the end of season two. And that's the end of that portion of Gundam. Like I know Gundam is kind of like Power Rangers, where the timeline kind of jumps around. You're in like different universes as well. So it's that kind of idea. So that, yeah, I went on a weird tangent with Gundam, not to get back to Spy Family. But I did enjoy Gundam 00 for what it's worth. Derek, if you're listening, I have watched it a couple times on Hulu, and I'm mad that they don't have the movies on there. Aww. I'm sure Crunchyroll does. Crunchyroll, not a sponsor, but could be.
It should be.
Dear should Lord. Be, yeah. The only problem I have with Crunchyroll is that if you are watching in the dub, you do not get the dub with subtitles unless yes. you're watching in a different language. Like, I still appreciate the subtitles because sometimes I don't hear what they say properly. And so the subtitles work for me because I can just do a quick glance down. Okay, they said that. So the lack of subtitles, Crunchyroll, even in the English dub, like, hard of hearing people still speak English. Like, just because, like, maybe hard of hearing people don't want to watch the subtitles. Maybe they want to hear, but have that opportunity. I'm going deaf in my left ear. I can still hear, but I like to have that backup.
Having subtitles on while having the dub is something I appreciate, because every once in a while it's like, I'm not sure that's what they meant to say. And then you read the subtitles and it's like, there's more context. There's more nuance. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, and it doesn't seem like it's that hard of an integration to do, but they just don't want to do it for some reason. Not saying we won't take your money, Crunchyroll, if you want to throw us a sponsorship, but you know, just some continuous improvement suggestions.
Oh yeah. I mean, Crunchyroll, thank you. We love your live, you know, next day streaming for a bunch of the shows that my wife watches. She would, every morning she'd be like, okay, cool. So it's Tuesday, so this is on Wednesday. These two shows dropped. Thursday, this. And now she's sad that a lot of the shows have ended. And now she says to wait for the next season or pick something new.
Has she watched My Dress Up Darling yet? If she's into Slice of Life?
She loves Slice Life. I will mention that one to her. Our like catalog of like the backlog of the watch list is the longest on Crunchyroll.
Well, My Dress Up Darling currently is only one season, 12 episodes.
Okay.
I strongly recommend it. The only issue I have with that entire show is that it is a little leering for the subject matter, where it's a 14-year-old girl, maybe 15, where we get a lot of busty shots and a lot of booty shots.
Of course we do. That is the blessing and the curse of anime.
Yes. Ricky and I have been watching Fruits Basket, and I've been surprised at how tame it is with some of those things. Mm-hmm. And then this most recent episode we watched, they were at the beach. And the first thing that happens is once they say, let's go to the beach, is you get the booty shot.
Oh, yeah. No.
Of the girl that has been like the most meek, the most timid, the most sweet, angelic person ever. Like, by the way, she's sexy, too. Just so you know, she's in a one piece. But look at that booty.
You still haven't watched I Was Reincarnated as a Slime, have you?
No, I have not seen that one yet.
So I love that show because it is it's like if a pacifist was trying to do well, because he's a 38-year-old something Japanese man who gets randomly stabbed in the street and reincarnates as a lowly slime and builds his way up and starts building an empire. It's fantastic. I love it. Freaking love the show.
That one and the vending machine one that Slade had mentioned are two of the big ones that are on my list, along with the Rise of the Shield Hero, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Solo Leveling was another really good one that came out this year that I caught, that my wife was watching and I was kind of passively enjoying. But anyway, sorry, the slime one, it has a little bit of the leering, but it's mostly, I feel like it's mostly in on its own joke because he's a slime. He can't do anything. So it's mostly like they're fawning over him because he's like a good leader. And so like he has two secretaries who like fight over him, but then he's a slime. So he gets like stretched out. He's like, please stop. So they both, when they carry him under their boobs because he's a slime. You know? And it's just, it's so funny.
So it's got a little Konosuba in it.
Yeah, of course. And what happens,
self-aware.
They have, of course, they have a hot spring that they relax at after their battle or something like that. And so he's on the,
this is
the
just guy, hot water.
Yeah. So he's on the guy's side. And he's just a slime, so he's just floating on top, and they put like a little tea towel on his head. But he's not allowed to go to the women's side, even though he's a genderless slime. You know, it's just, it's funny because he's just like, oh, okay, so I'm a slime. That's all right. Hmm. Oh, crap. Okay. Last thing. As one of the things about the world they fall into is if you name something, not what they are like ogre, but if you give them an actual proper name, like, you know, Steve or whatever, they empower and level up into something else. Like from going to a goblin, hobgoblin to become a full goblin or something like that.
Okay.
And so every time they do, they level up, the guys get like more burly and, you know, it's taller, burly, ripped. And the women become taller and dainty and more human like. And he's like, why does this work in this world? Why are they now? They went from goblins to goblininas. it's a comfort show for me. I absolutely just damn love it. That was way off track for Spy Family.
All right, let's hear from Antonio. We've got a couple more episodes of Animation April with The Cultworthy, and we'll be right back.
The Cultworthy Podcast. Join me, Antonio Palacios, each week as I guide you through a never-ending sea of obscure cinema and cultworthy gems that deserve a rediscovery. Find me on all listening platforms and at thecultworthy.com. The Cultworthy Podcast. Join us.
And we're back. We're here to talk about Zack Snyder's Star Wars knockoff that Alex keeps calling me a hater for just because I speak the truth, man.
It is okay to break the fourth wall. I keep calling you a hater because all you did was show me tweets of people not liking this damn movie before I even finished it.
I'm just putting the truth out there, which last time I looked, it was like 18% with 23 reviews. And I think even the viewer numbers were just absolutely in the tank.
Rotten Tomato.
Yeah, let me find that real quick here. No, I don't. I already watched Shogun. I don't need to do that. And Anthony Hopkins bot. That is the only part of this movie I care anything about.
Oh, we'll get to that.
67 reviews, 18% from the critics, which that's probably, that feels like it's even down from the previous movie, just the reviews. And then there's 500 plus reviews at 52%. So, like, not even the Snyder bots can get this thing up into a fresh score for the viewer score.
Hey, okay, first off, looking at A Child of Fire, it is not that big of a drop. It is 3% from 21 to
21%. And the even the viewership numbers are 58% to 53%.
Shut up.
Lord. 173 reviews to get up to 21%, where this one has 60 reviews.
It has nowhere reviews to go but up.
67 reviews for 18%. There's 105 fewer reviews, and it's 3% lower.
It's only been out for about
it's
60 hours. Okay. To mention IMDb, currently the first one is a 5.7. The second one is a 5.2. See,
I think that's fair. I think a 5.7 is very fair for what the first movie was.
Okay, Josh.
Yes.
You mentioned that this is a Star Wars saga. So my wife came in as I was starting the second half of this one. I broke it up a little bit because, like I said, I was sick.
A likely story.
And as she walks into the room, she sees a screen. After about 30 seconds, she sits down and says, "Is this one of the Star Wars movies or shows?" Pause it. Give her a quick rundown. I'm like, "You can leave the room anytime." She finished it with me. Now, Josh, where we last left off, Korra had put together her Magnificent Seven.
Yep. Seven Samurai, yes.
Yep. They landed back on apparently what is the Rebel Moon to cheer on the heroes. They had killed Francis, the bad guy, Admiral, whatever his name is.
Francis, yeah.
Yep, Darth Francis. And the end teaser thing showed his body being recovered. They jacked him into the Matrix. He got yelled at by Belisarius.
Cary Elwes is the Emperor?
The dead Emperor is Cary Elwes. This is okay. Belisarius, who is Korra's adoptive father. I forget who plays Belisarius. Fra Fifi is the actor's name who plays Belisarius. Anyways, he's not really in it much. So this is the second half of the movie. This is a Star Wars movie. You have the gang together. We have seen enough Magnificent Seven, Three Amigos. What do you believe is the plot of this movie? Mind you, it is shorter. It is shorter. It's only 2 hours and 2 minutes long.
So I have to ask one precluding question.
Go for it.
Does this close out the storyline, or is it left open for sequels?
The very last 2 minutes of this fucking movie is literally them explaining what the next adventure is and the tagline for the poster. I will not go into spoilers yet. When we go into that, I will bitch.
We close out this adventure. So if this is Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven, A New Hope, just stretched out into like a 4.5 hour movie.
Soon to be 6 hours, yes.
So we've already assembled our team. We have to get the training montage.
That happens.
And if we're also doing the Three Amigos, we have to train the villagers as well.
That happens.
So not only do we have to learn to work as a team, we have to train the village to do at least basic military tactics.
Mm-hmm.
We have to set up a storyline with the girl who was almost raped in the previous movie.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony Hopkins is playing the Han Solo, where he's going to abandon them and then return in the final fight.
Ooh, okay. You're like 5 for 5. Keep going.
We have Francis being resurrected, which that's kind of newish, but it's also just like taking the end of A New Hope and just blasting Empire Strikes Back into it in the middle of it. What do we got going on with Francis here?
Before we go, Francis, let's return the villagers real quickly. What is the intention that the Empire wants from them?
The Empire wants their grain, their wheat.
Correct.
And Francis said he's going to take like 112% of their crop, which makes sense. And he's gonna take it in 3 weeks. So they I guess they also have to pretend like they're still farming. Like they're gonna lure them into a trap, and they're gonna be like, "Yeah, yes, we there got everything." We
go. Uh huh.
So it's kind of like the Battle of Endor, where they lure them. Yep. Because Yavin wasn't really a trap. That was basically a defense maneuver where they were just like, "We have to put up a counter offense to try and even survive." So we have them still having to harvest their grain and do all that. We have to do a subplot where Blade Legs from the Kingsman movie, she gets a new haircut. Yeah, Blade's Lady, Blade's Legs.
Yep.
she does the Jack Bauer shaving at the end of season 2, episode 1 thing, but instead it's a haircut.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Literally right before the battle, to which my wife also remarked, "Wow, she cut her hair really neatly."
We need the love story. So we need the Han Solo, Princess Leia thing happening. So Anthony Hopkins bot and girl who almost got raped, they rekindle and reconnect.
Ooh, swing and miss.
It's Korra and what's his face that's not Han Solo from the Gunner. First movie.
Yep.
Yeah, I was pretty sure he was going to betray them, but it ended up not Jai Courtney. Charlie Hunnam?
Yeah.
Which he was the best part of that movie besides Anthony Hopkins, but sucks that he died.
All right. So that's everything that leads up to the battle. Now, Francis is alive. the battle's going to happen. Mind you, if you see in trailer, you know the battle's going to happen. Heck, all the interviews, everything is about how this is a war movie. This is a war movie. What is your prediction for Francis?
Well, if he's being established as the Darth Vader, he has to be dismembered, but not die.
Okay.
That would be my guess, is he's horribly maimed, scarred, because it is the Scar Giver. Again, we didn't make the joke before, but gimmick infringement, that's my thing. So I that would be my guess, is that he's horribly maimed and sent back to the Emperor, whoever, to send a message and saying, we're coming for you.
And the adventure continues.
Yes.
Okay. And full of spoilers, because this is the entire plot of the movie. Francis is reawoken and is like, I need to go after her. She's on Vent. They cut to Vent, which is apparently the Rebel Moon's name. They arrive and they're like, hey, there are six of us. We are the
three amigos.
And they tell the people, they're like, you must fight. So they will be here in like 5 days' time. How long does it take to harvest? At least half a cycle. We're going to do it in 3 days. Oh, 3 days? What? Oh, my gosh. That's impossible. We're going to work around the clock 24 hours a day. So what happens immediately? Korra and Gunner bang. As they bang, Korra then afterwards, laying upon his chest, tells him her backstory, which is how she became the Scar Giver. I guess Nookie makes her want to revisit dark places, because
pillow talk.
Yeah. I mean,
you clearly aren't watching Shogun, because that's what that's what they used back then. That's what the Shogun used back then, is they let men, quote unquote, pillow their women in the hopes that they really love chit chatting. Sex position, my man.
So yeah, so they're laying there, no PG-13, no nudity. And you find out her backstory. So basically what happened is Belisarius, her adoptive father, is like, you know, so listen, Kariel's is too nice of a man. He has conquered enough. He wants to wind down the military-industrial complex. So at the christening of the last dreadnought, which is going to be christened in the young daughter's, the young ward's name, because this will be a vessel of peace instead of war, they, no joke, straight up Julius Caesar style,
just stab him in the back.
Stab him.
Because nuance is too much of a thing.
Yeah. Now, mind you, this is the funniest part of the damn movie. Because it's a christening, there's a band playing. And the band is in this like beautiful gothic attire. They're playing the music. The assassination happens. They're still playing. They also kill the wife. And Belisarius had ordered Korra, she knew what to do, to kill the princess. And so she's there dangling her, you know, gun, like doesn't sure she wants to do it because she's blood bound, whatever, to him as he dubbed her. She has to. The princess says, it's OK, I forgive you. And so she shoots her in the head. Princess dies. There's like this explosion of like white, like the healing magic from within her came out and then like was released. And then immediately Belisarius, while a band is still playing.
Yeah, it's the Reigns of Castamere.
Yeah, like Daft Punk and the Reigns of Castamere in Tron. They're just there. And he goes, traitor, look what she did to the royal family. Mind you, the 30 like senators who all took part in the stabbing are like, oh my gosh, yes, she's a traitor. They all have knives. She's the only one with the gun. So what does she do? She shoots her way out of the ship.
Brought a knife to a gunfight. Yeah.
Didn't kill any of the senators. She just turns around, starts killing guards, takes the elevator, leaves.
Well, yeah, they're politicians. They're not going to do shit.
Oh, no. Why, you know, why would she kill them? Anyway, so she gives her backstory. Then it's about 20 minutes of Ridley Scott wheat porn that he wishes he put in the Gladiator movie, because they harvest for 3 days and it is slow-mo, beautiful wheat being felled, being reaped, thrown onto the little hover wagons, being ground into flour and sifted into bags.
Man, you just earwormed me for no reason. That Hans Zimmer score, just na no ma no no na no mo na na no na no no na no 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 na. I love that Gladiator score.
It is good. So there's 2 days left, and they have to train the villagers.
So it's time for more banging.
No. They're having a feast to celebrate this and to thank them for the help and doing something. Apparently it takes like 14 days and three. And the young blonde woman who bonded with Anthony Bot has somehow in those 3 days taken the time to make little banner tapestries for each of the six heroes and gives them a backstory about what this tapestries and embroidery means. Why wasn't she out? Anyways, not important. It is an unearned moment where she explains what each person's archetype is. It makes no sense. I have no idea where she learned it.
Again, nuance is too much of a thing. No time for nuance. We just got to show and tell.
So 2 days of weapons training. Of course, the blonde is wonderful with like a big ass shotgun and immediately blows things head off. They do show them, hey, listen, your guys are villagers. You use harvesting tools. Use them to attack. Some of them get guns. They fortify. They decide to protect the grain by using the grain as barricades because you can't attack the buildings if there's grain there. Makes sense. Okay, Francis arrives. He lands and he's like, hey, listen, Cora, your name is actually Athreleus or something like that. It's some very Roman sounding name. You are the scar giver. And he shows like his chest where she like, gave him a scar where she shot him and stabbed him. He's like, I bear this. I'm taking you to Belisarius. We're going to the mother world. He's like, I will let the village live if you come with us. And she, after having her haircut, goes, okay. So she turns around, gives Gunnar a hug and says, okay, I'm going to go with them. They'll say they'll spare you all and leave the grain because they want me. What do you think happens?
Gunnar gets a boner and decides to fire openly.
Correct. Gunnar takes her gun, turns around because basically there's an old man with a hammer at a bell. He was going to ring the bell. He turns around, fires the gun into the bell. The bell goes off. The war begins. This is where Gunnar gets half the village killed. Because, of course, if this is the Magnificent Seven, half of the Magnificent Seven have to die. And so you have Nemesis, the lady who uses the lightsabers with an awesome, cool, kind of brimmed hat, passes on while defending the women and children. You have another one of the guys die trying to fight Francis to stop Francis from running away after.
Does Jaimin Hinsu's streak end at one?
He lives to the end.
Wow. So don't worry about that. He's going to survive three consecutive movies?
Possibly.
Rebel Moon 1, Rebel Moon 2, and A Quiet Place Day 1. He survives.
I still hope the way Quiet Place Day 1 ends is a jump to the future where he dies.
Or maybe it'll jump to a future where he's like just hanging on for dear life, and we retcon that he survived in A Quiet Place Part 2.
Exactly. The Bad Hobbits. Mind you, the battle is glorious. It is beautiful. It looks amazing. They're using like, instead of blood, they're using like when they shoot through people, it looks like the plasma, kind of like from Harry Potter, where the wands are connecting, the plasma is falling on the ground.
Yeah, they did that in the last movie. Yeah.
But they're really overselling it here. Oh, yeah. There was a brief moment where everyone gave their backstory, their reason for fighting. It's not important. It's very unearned. It makes no sense. We're like, tomorrow we're going to fight. So everyone must say why the Empire is evil. Okay, sure. And there's some beautiful backstory moments. I mean, mind you, some of the lore stuff here is amazing. Like, Nemesis's lore is that she came from a people who were battle hardened but went to a life of peace. The mother world attacked, most everyone died but her. She goes to the temple where their old weapons are, and she's not a robot. What she does is she heats up the not lightsabers, slices her forearm off, and attaches in place the mechanical gauntlets that her people used in war. So that's how she can wield the lightsaber. And then she does it to their side. Amazing lore. Lots and lots of battle happens. Lots of people die. Some fake out deaths. Anthony Hopkins shows up. Anthony Bot saves the day because he activates full robot battle mode and takes out an entire not AT-AT himself. Looks badass doing it. He's got the deer antlers going. He's got a cloak. The deer antlers, for some reason, are covered in blood. Who knows why? Not important.
That's for the R-rated cut.
Yep.
He's going to gore someone.
Cora and Gunnar sneak onto the ship because she has her own ship. So they, when Francis is running away, because that's what Francis does, they fall into formation, which makes sense. You know, okay, yeah, they lost a few of them, but they're not really counting how many there are. You get the interior of the dreadnought, looks very cool. Francis wants to just blow them all up because fuck it, kill them all. I don't care anymore. We'll make sure Cora dies with them. Stuff happens. The dreadnought's sinking. Francis and her have a lightsaber battle because this is Star Wars. You have to have a lightsaber battle. Now, the reason why this movie ends on a cliffhanger is because there is a dismemberment and an explosion. Francis loses his head because Cora chops it off.
Okay. I was close.
Yep. Now, we don't see the body, but we do see the head move away. And who knows how good they are at putting things back together? Because one of the coolest shots of this movie, and this movie is gorgeous, is when he's coming out of the not back to tank. It's like this webbing all over his body and arms. Like they kind of like weaved him back together. And then they have to rip him out of it, kind of like an orc from Lord of the Rings. You know, they rip them out of the mud thing. It's gorgeous. Looks amazing. Never explained what it is. So she lands. She loses her lover because, you know, somebody's got to die. and Cora's got to be available for the next one. And this is why this movie pisses me off, because you're right, because it does end in a cliffhanger. As they're standing there, Star Wars style, if there's a bunch of dead people, what do you have to do?
In Star Wars, dead people, you have to burn them?
Mm-hmm. Individual pyres for each person.
Oh, man.
And as they're standing there and they're like, yes, we did it. We saved the day. They will not be coming back, because if you kill the Admiral, we'll flee back to the Mother World. They will know to leave us alone. We have our grain. We have our freedom. And Cora looks at them and says, I have been lying to you all this time. You do not know who I am. I am Athrellus. And Jonaman Hensu says, yeah, I know who you are. And she goes, no, you don't understand. I am the Scar Giver. I killed the princess. And he's like, yeah, no, I know who you are. I already said that. And he literally says that to her, like, yeah, no, I said I know who you are. And he's like, but you're wrong. And she goes, what? Mind you, Hopkins Bot is there. And he says, the princess cannot be killed so easily with a gun. She is alive. She's in hiding. He says, we must take this fight to the Mother World by restoring the Empire's line. And Anthony Bot goes, if there is an empire, if there is a royal member of the royalty alive, I must fight and defend them. Because that's his duty, right? They're all duty bound, sure. And that's why they're kicking his ass. He had nothing to do. And so this is where they end. He says, now us together, the remaining Magnificent Seven, we have our mission. We must find her and fight. And then Cora goes, like, straight deadpan to the camera, find her and fight. Boom, Rebel Moon Part 2.
that sounds pretty cringe. So now they're going on a journey to find an ethereal form?
Or she's been reborn, or she's in a chrysalis, reincarnated. I don't know.
They're
going to
do Kingdom of the Crystal Skull?
Maybe. there's so much beauty in this moment. In this movie, the way they do the hologram thing, like in this tube, and they reform to the person speaking, and they can actually tilt the tube and like use it to actually be like projector maps and stuff. They establish lore for the lightsabers. At one point, Cora is fighting her way through the thing, is able to kill a person who has one of the lightsabers. She picks it up and she screams and lets it go, because apparently, I didn't notice this, but if no one can hold a lightsaber if they're not wearing some kind of glove. And I was like, oh yeah, all the guys are wearing gloves. The Nemesis has her mechanical hands. Yeah, whatever plasma thing going on. Okay, I guess that kind of makes sense. And they don't explain it. They just show her like scream and drop it. And then she like rips off part of her like clothing or something, wraps the hell out of like her hand and its handle. And then she goes to war with it. I'm like, okay, cool. That makes sense. Like there's little show don't tell moments, but none of the beats of the character have any place mattering. When Nemesis bites it, this little young blonde kid walks up and like is like crying in front of her, like, oh, I'm so sorry you're dying, blah 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 blah. There was one moment establishing their connection, which is that during the harvest she was kind of like laying there like chewing on a piece of wheat or something like that, and he kind of comes up to her and she goes like boo, and he like runs away or something like that. That was their entire emotional connection beat, for him to bawl for 5 minutes as she dies. And then of course all the villagers surround her body as she's passing away, because she was defending the women and children, you know, the old people and the young people. And it's just like, this is unearned. Den getting killed by Francis and body kicked out of the ship as they're escaping. That's unearned. I don't even know his name was Den until the subtitle says like Den groans. And I'm like, oh, that's Den.
Is that the guy who rides Buckbeak in the first one?
No, not John Carter. He lives and eventually puts on a shirt.
Oh man. Well, yeah, that's a death sign right there.
But he's alive. He was just wearing a shirt at the funeral burning scene. So I'm like, oh, hey, he found a shirt.
Oh, okay. I mean, yeah, at least he's respectful.
Yeah. But
she would have wanted it this way.
Yeah. And speaking of the subtitles thing, because I tend to watch with subtitles on, just because unless I have like a 7.1 sound system and have it cranked to 10, balancing the movies is terrible these days, and TV shows, yeah. Music's often over it. And like there was something where like the cannons of the giant dreadnought just like power up, and it said something like the king's sword lance or something like that powering up. And I'm like, that's a cool name for that. I mean, if it's a badass dreadnought, the main cannon, the lance of the king.
Yeah,
that's cool. They don't say that. They just say fire up the cannon. I want to say that this movie is better than the first one. The only reason I say it's better is ooh, big pretty explosions and lightsabers. Yay. The 4-year-old inside of me is like, yay! Ooh, look, lightsabers, they're fighting as the ship is slowly crashing Earth and sliding and dicing and they're kind of leaping off things. And Francis has a wonderful I'm over the shit face. And Sophia, I can't remember how to pronounce her last name, but Cora, she's an amazing at this role. She is invested. She's powerful and physical, and she's emoting like hell, selling her journey. They totally John McClane her, because as this battle goes on, her shirt is getting dirtier and bloodier, and she's collecting more and more injuries. And it obviously must be like a diehard thing of like, well, she's not changing clothes, she's gonna get dirtier, she's gonna get more banged up, she's gonna have more scars, everything's gonna happen. You gotta do this diehard of the style of like, by the end of the thing, she needs to be black and red from soot and blood, you know.
Yeah, Sophia Boutella.
Boutella, thank you. Sophia Boutella. She's fantastic at this. Anthony Hopkins' few moments in this are fantastic. Like, seeing his BattleBot go hardcore was great.
I think that was the only reason I was interested in even trying to see this movie, was because I wanted to see how much he was in this movie and if the animation for the character was as amazing as it was in the first one. He's only in that movie for maybe 5 minutes, but it crossed beyond Uncanny Valley into just like, yeah, that robot exists right now. It's just there. Like, it's not even Uncanny Valley.
Yeah.
It's just you are immersed in the way that thing moves and the way that thing looks. And I was like, I need to know more, because him doing the little Peter Griffin laugh with the reindeer antlers at the end of the first movie, I needed more.
Yeah, he is spying on her, like, he spies on them as they're doing everything. He has, like, one good scene where you find out his name is Jimmy.
That's disappointing.
Yeah. She's like, oh, hi, Jimmy. And he's like, no one has called me that since blah, 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 blah. They normally call me whatever, Boil, Guard Bot, whatever. And she's like, okay, I won't do that. And he's like, no, I like it when you call me that. And then he has like a, and then he shows up, does some badass things for half a second, which is badass. And at the end, he's like, well, if the royal line continues, my duty is to guard and defend it and slaughter all who, you know.
Quick question.
Yeah, go for it.
Do we get more from the defector of the Imperium, the guy who tried to defend a blonde girl from the village?
Yes.
Because they were clearly trying to establish that, like, he's attracted to her and he love at first sight, whatever. And he, because of the assault that was attempted on her, he essentially turned back on his oath and betrayed his squad mates to try and protect her along with Cora and Jimmy. So they just kind of cut it off from there. Like, he stayed behind to protect her and the village while they went and collected their 7 samurai. And now that they're back, I was curious what, if anything, happened with that storyline.
That storyline is taken out back and shot in the head, because what could have been interesting was they show him giving updates to the command, and Francis immediately goes, he's obviously churned. The others are all dead. We cannot trust him. And I'm like, motherfucker, you know that just from that one hologram thing. Okay. But yeah, that's it. He fights with him. He and Blondie are in love. That's it.
Yeah. That's annoyingly just short-sighted, I guess would be the right term.
She's badass with one of the guns, and like, he gets knocked down at one point and she blows somebody, like, guy's head off with one of the guns.
Yeah, like, that's absolutely fine. I'm fine with, like, changing up, doing a role change where the damsel in distress is actually the soldier, and the I'm cool with that.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
You set something up that is genuinely interesting. You're just going to forget about it because you've got to do a 7 samurai, 3 amigos.
For his story, they could have done something more along the lines of him earning their trust a little bit more. They could have had him be a little conflicted, maybe use him to try to turn over Cora or something like that. You know, the whole like, oh yes, I pretended to work with you guys and now I'm actually turning against you. So at least Francis and them go like, oh cool, so you, oh man, we had a little bit wrong. And then the reveal happens, no, actually I'm a triple crosser.
It's a double turn. Yeah,
yeah.
Instead of you do the Charlie Hunnam thing again. Yeah. But then you do the Han Solo thing where it's like, oh, he was actually on the good guy's side the whole time.
No. What other questions do you got for this lack of plot?
That was the only, the Anthony Hopkins bot and that were really the only things I genuinely cared about. Is there any more allusions to hentai, or is that just shoved to the wayside?
It's all shoved to the wayside.
I sound more disappointed.
It's just a human on human violence story with mecha and machines. There's no there's no journeying the galaxy anymore. It's just it's the whole small village.
It's fairly stationary. It's either you're on Harvest or you're on the ship.
Yep, that's basically the two sets. You're in the village or you're there. And there are so many, there are like weird ideas in this film. Like, so she, as she's planting bombs to, you know, blow up the dreadnought when she sneaks aboard it to get at Francis, at one point she shoots somebody. He falls down like scaffolding and he lands like in the belly of the ship on a pile of coal, to which then she kind of hops down and starts killing some of the people down there because they saw a body fall. And so she's killing the people, shoving coal into the furnaces, which does make you wonder why a spaceship runs Titanic style on coal.
That is a very fair question.
Why does the dreadnought run on coal but the little spaceships don't? It's a fantastic
because
retro.
It looks cool.
Yeah, I mean, it looks cool, and I find it staggeringly interesting. Maybe they made an offhand comment like, well, actually, you know, they turn the coal, actually processes it down into diamonds, and the diamonds are then using the laser crystals to fire the... Oh, okay, I missed that part. You know, my verdict on this is if you watch the first one and you enjoyed it, you should watch to see how it ends, because it's a glorious, beautiful battle. If you have no interest, don't bother watching it. Now, here's the thing that I'm going to say that's probably going to piss you off. This is probably a top six Star Wars film for me. Because at least I am seeing a weird retro beautiful version of Star Wars that is not religiously devout to episodes 4 through 6. That is something that is my main problem that I have right now with anything that has come out in the Disney era of Star Wars. Is as much as I love The Mandalorian, and yes, I still need to watch Andor, but as much as I love The Mandalorian, Rogue One, Solo, Mando, Boba Fett, 7 through 9, they all seem intent upon basking in the reverence of something that happened 50 years ago. I really feel like if those were lightsabers, if they were lightsabers, if they just went in there and just CGI touch-upped every vehicle to a Star Wars vehicle, this could be a post-6, post-9 story about the Empire, because you have the small village uprising against the Empire. Who needs this? I mean, the story about needing grain, which they don't explain why they need grain, but apparently they actually literally need grain because they're starving. This could be like post-6, post-9, where it's like the Empire is struggling, and this is the story of a backwater planet like Tatooine struggling under the thumb of the oppressors. And there is something out there, something to give them hope. You know, there was like a child who knew the Force in some kind. Maybe the Empire was, you know, trying to establish a kind of peace, and the evil, you know, the evil Nazi Sith, because Lord knows that's what all the Empire is, want to get rid of her to continue the machinations. We can't have this continuing, because the Emperor knew Sith stuff and Vader. We got to get rid of that crap, and we got to just be industrial. You know, something. It is a Star Wars story.
Yeah,
but it's so badly told.
Yes, Zack Snyder is a guy. This has been said ad nauseum. He's a guy that would be an amazing cinematographer, maybe even a really good producer, but he should not be in charge of story. And he should not be in charge of directing.
Yeah, I would love for him to storyboard cinematography, sit down with me with special effects, give me some editing tips. I would love for him to shepherd my project, but I would want to rewrite it and have somebody else direct it, because the pieces are all there for a visual feast, but the humanity is lost in how he touches it.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. Because and that's what we go to these movies for. Like, yeah, there's spectacle to it, but we still need to be able to relate to and engage with these characters, even if they are archetypes, for lack of a better word. You can make them engaging and you can make them interesting. Yeah. And he just does not care to do that. He has his visual storytelling that he wants to get across, and he does not really care about anything else that gets in the way of that.
Yeah. No, like... So the whole everyone explaining their backstory of why they hate the Empire, that could have been actually a really powerful moment if it lingered a little bit more. But it felt so awkwardly shoved in there of like, yeah, we're gonna go to war tomorrow, so everybody, it's like they're trying to do the Jaws Indianapolis moment, right? Where he's talking about the sinking event. And that is such a powerful part of that movie. But it makes sense in the context of the moment because they've been out at sea for a while. They're getting drunk. They're telling war stories. And they build up to that. This is felt like literally they sit down and go like, okay, cool. Tomorrow, we know we're going to war. Everybody needs to tell me right now, what did they do to you? And it's like, this isn't how it works. And like I said, Nemesis, her backstory of like what happened, that like little vignette of like 3 minutes, there's so much beauty in them watching her, you know, dismember herself and take on the oppression of the rage and the pain of what her people were because they're forced back into being a war people. That is beautiful, but it's unearned in the moment. It doesn't feel natural. I feel for her character, but I don't feel like it does anything for the story. Mm-hmm. You know, and then of course, you know, she dies and I'm like, I want to feel more. And the actress was emoting her heart out and gave it her all with that. But I felt the machinations at play of the whole, like, you should feel something. Feel something now. It's like, no, I don't need, you know, I don't need to be poked in the back of like, did you feel it? Did you feel it? Did you feel it? Did you feel it? Are you crying yet? We need to go on to the next murder scene. Okay. There's a war happening outside these walls.
We've got a space vagina to get to you know, really drive home that we're going to the mother world. Because nuance does not exist in these movies.
Find her and fight.
Find her and fight?
Yeah. They're going to go find her and fight.
I would change the punctuation on them. Find her and fight? Are we fighting her or are we finding her then fighting elsewhere? Like, where are we fighting? Who are we fighting? Who is her?
I don't know. I think we should just fight everybody. I mean,
the Family Guy, got to cap these off with Family Guy jokes now, apparently. The Family Guy joke, the little guy in the golf course, you want to fight about it? Yeah, I live in a hole in the golf course. You want to fight about it?
Well, now I'm thinking in my head, his Peter's confession to the family as we're about to die. I did not care for the Godfather. It insists upon itself. Which, yes, in these moments where I'm supposed to be feeling emotion, it insists upon itself that I give a shit about the Magnificent Seven here. I do not.
We've seen the Magnificent Seven. It's really good. And we've seen Seven Samurai. Very good.
Fantastic.
We like, yes, it has been troped for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But we can do better. And that's I feel like that's what we say for almost every movie review we do anymore is it could be better. We can do better. But everything just gets so watered down.
I hate that feeling too, because that super bothers me. It's not that I think that necessarily that movies as an entertainment just can't be good. They have to be better. They can't just be good, they have to be better. No. You know, and it's rare that we get a masterpiece like Godzilla Minus One. But the part that bothers me about these movies is that you can.
Sorry, you said Godzilla Minus One. I heard Godzilla X Kong. That's why I laughed. Just thinking, yes, beat up your redheaded stepchildren.
Well, okay, to use those two, as we talked about it, our previous review of those movies, Godzilla Minus One is perfect for what it is. It's my favorite movie of last year. I have no notes other than some of it. I couldn't tell if some of the humor was intentional or not. It might have been a cultural thing. Godzilla Kong, I didn't need it to be better. I didn't need it to be anything more than it was because it set out to do what it wanted to do. And that is good. I don't need to give it notes. They knew what movie they were making. It was hysterical. It's perfect as it is as a piece of popcorn entertainment, which is why it's making so much damn money worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have something like Ghostbusters Frozen Empire where you could feel the machine behind it trying to do something and it didn't quite work. And I still hope it breaks even. I hope they try it one more time. But when you have Rebel Moon 1 and 2 and you know, if you're, you know,
and there are movies that he has been given carte blanche to as well.
Yeah.
They are his visions. And the fact that they're doing a director's cut where it's a 5.5-hour long epic.
Yeah.
Not needed. Among other things, Like, I will gladly sit through a part one, part two. I will not sit down for a 5-hour director's cut.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is I know he wants to do Star Wars. Like, this would have been in Star Wars. And there is a world here that is fascinating. But are my complaints because of the intentional machinations of Netflix and the director's cut taking away from this experience? Is there... This is not Lord of the Rings and Lord of the Rings extended. I do not have a beautiful experience and then a superior experience. I feel like I'm having an underserved experience. And if that director's cut isn't perfectly cooked, medium rare with a sizzle, then I've just wasted 10 hours of my life to be played with by the algorithm.
And that I think that plays into it a little bit as well, though, because you're sitting there thinking, okay, what's getting extended? Like, we pretty much nailed what's coming in part one at the very least. Like, we know we're getting that hentai sex scene. We know we're getting a lot of Darth Francis stuff. And Zack Snyder is pretty much confirmed. He's like, oh yeah, it's gonna be sexier, it's gonna be gorier. And it's like, yeah, okay, we know you wanted to do that hentai scene. Like, we get it. You foreshadowed that very, very much. But if that's really all you're doing is there's going to be a subplot where blonde girl bangs defector boy and we're getting octopus sex with Darth Francis and we're getting a nipple or two in the PG-13 sex scene from this one. Like, is that worthy of a director's cut if it's not affecting the story? If you're not adding to the context of these scenes, if you're not adding to the backstories of these characters, the dialogue, you're not building these characters, which also it feels like you're intentionally sabotaging this just so people can watch the extended cut and be like, oh man, the story's so much better now. Why not release it as two movies that are complete? Like, that's the shit that EA did in the early 2010s, where if you bought the game brand new, you get day one DLC. That was supposed to be part of the movie, but because they're trying to get their hands in the reseller pot, they decided that they're going to put a $10 code in there and give you free DLC.
Yeah.
But if you buy it pre-owned, you don't get that $10 game or that $10 DLC, and you have to pay $10 for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this kind of feels like, is you have to maintain your subscription until we decide to release this, which now the previous rumor was that we'll get the extended cut prior to this one coming out. Now it's like, oh, maybe September.
Yeah.
And like, we still don't even fully know. Like, it sounds like it's going to be part one, part two mashed together into one movie. But like, why?
Yeah.
Your Netflix, your streaming service, there's no reason for this, especially when they said, Zack Snyder, make your movie. There's no reason for them to be like, PG-13 cut. Oh, the Deadpool movie did so well with the PG-13 cut with Fred Savage. Who cares? Like, that was that was a novelty. Yeah. Where this is you intentionally bastardizing your movie to try and get people to watch a longer movie that just has a few extra scenes. And that's part of the reason why I canceled my Netflix subscription, along with the WWE purchase for their streaming rights. Like, I knew that meant that, I think it was on like the $24 a month plan. That plan's probably going to go up to $30 by this time next year when the WWE is over on the network.
Yep.
And I can't afford $30 a month. That's too much for me. So, like, sorry, Netflix, unless you want to send us a sponsorship deal, which after me bad-mouthing you, I'm sure you don't. But, you know, weirder things have happened.
Let me bring it back. Is It Cake season 3 was really good. I love that. Nailed it. The new kind of like Great British Baking style kind of like format they had last year, where, you know, they should be releasing a new season soon. Like the new format. Very cute. Very fun. I dig it. So
Voltron Legendary Defender is a fantastic show.
Delicious in the Dungeon. Bring some more. Yeah, we got that. It's okay.
Bridgerton.
Netflix.
Ricky loves Bridgerton. She'll talk Bridgerton on the show.
I just got to say, it's okay, Netflix. Let us soothe you a little bit. You can just ignore the fact that I'm on the $6.99 plan, because I don't mind ads. Like, you know, I mean, you're very gentle with the ads. One before the show starts, about 30 seconds, and sometimes one in the middle. But that movie, watch it. There was no ad break. I appreciate it. Thank you, Netflix. Don't listen to Josh. Send the free subscription code my way.
That's fine. I'll just password share.
I'll just slip it in a little bit every once in a while of like, Netflix, definitely a sponsor.
All right, Alex. And let's let everyone know about how they could potentially win a Steam edition copy of Marvel Midnight Suns.
We're coming up on episode 150 here. It's going to be fantastic. We've got another SmackDowns coming, and we want suggestions. We want the nitty gritty. We want to know who you think would defeat the other, or who do you think would be friends? We're going to hash this out, and all you have to do, just give us a little tweet, you know, a little tweet with this, with the hashtag SmackDowns, and you'll be entered into our raffle. But we want those opinions. We want those suggestions so we can destroy them for you when we decide they're all going to be friends and they're going to hug.
I had to remove one from our list because I've been going back and listening to our previous SmackDowns because I want to put them out on TikTok to try and drum up some social media engagement. On our first episode, we had someone suggest Daredevil versus Toph from Avatar: The Last Airbender. And we had another suggestion come through, which maybe was from the same person. I'd have to double check. But they suggested Toph versus Daredevil versus Hibernation Sickness Han Solo. I have a fight card made up because I forgot we did that fight. I'm going to have to make a spreadsheet while I go through this and like list all the fights we've done, so I don't get repeats. But I'm tempted to do that one just because we're adding Han Solo to the mix, but we've already talked about it, so I feel like the result is probably still the same. So, but I will leave that person in the raffle, and maybe we'll just do a quick one-off of like, yeah, Toph wins because she's the only one that's probably willing to kill two older gentlemen, where I feel like even Han Solo in hibernation sickness mode would probably be a little hesitant to kill a child.
Probably. But then again, Han Solo did, I mean, shoot a clone trooper war veteran and knock him into cell like that.
He didn't know. All right, Alex, let everyone know about our Discord as well.
Our Discord, that is, you can join it. It's the tsmack@gmail.com. You can have fun there. You can talk. You can let us know. Do we go too long? Do we go too short? Do you want us to complain more about extended cuts of things?
Do you want to hear Alex's thoughts on the Fallout series? He just finished.
I just finished that. I have thoughts. We need to do a bonus episode on that because it's so good. And it got confirmed for season 2, and I'm so excited about it. And Lucy's adorable, and oh my gosh, the part about the pimple, oh my gosh, oh my god, that metaphor is so wrong and so great. Wife and I were watching it out of nowhere. She kind of, I casually re-referenced it of like how absurd it was, and she goes, I mean, it's not wrong. I'm like, Oh, by the way, sorry. I apologize. Ed Skrein, also known as Francis, also known as, you know, as the Darth Nazi himself. You are doing our remix music and it's appreciated.
Is he a DJ in his spare time?
Yeah, he has actually a few albums out.
Interesting. Daft Skrein. Ed Punk. Follow us on social media at Talking Smack Pod on Blue Sky, Instagram, Threads, Hive Social, Post News, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Longy's website. Email us your Talking Smackdowns at tsmackpod@gmail.com. Leo Allen, thank you for the musical themes. Beppo for our original avatars, Retrail Studios for our Ricky avatar. Please like, subscribe, rate, review. And thanks so much for listening, everyone. Take care. Watch Star Trek.
Who loves T-Smack?
I love T-Smack. Is it true? Mm-hmm. I do. Ooh.